Well, thank you for joining us again on a Victorious Friday. I have a veteran with me. We've been trying to get it right three other times, have fallen short, so I had to invite him back to do it a fourth time. So let me welcome my good friend, George Barner. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Terrence. And I've been working hard, been studying, taking notes, trying to get ready. So don't throw me any curveballs here. I only hit the fastball. Okay.
Well, I thought we'd jump on and you would jump into some, a solo spot with one of the guitars or bass or something. And I've been disappointed each time.
We want to keep the audience, not lose the audience. Keep that in mind. Okay.
Well, that would have been if I would have accompanied you with some type of soloist. That's when we would have had a challenge there. But we'll pull it together next time. That gives us an excuse to come back again.
Great.
Well, today, I don't have to introduce my guest, but let me give some top highlights. He has an exciting new book coming out, or actually it may even be out already, Raising Spiritual Champions. How do we nurture our children's heart, mind, and soul? He's the director of research at the Cultural Center, Research Center at the Arizona Christian University. I'm excited to have him because this book, it's really bringing some golden nuggets. It's really talking about and geared towards the parents to help the parents disciple and to build a biblical worldview of their children. Well, as you know, Victoria's family, we're all about that. And so to have an expert on our show tonight to talk about some research that he's conducted, this new book, some insights, I'm honored. George, tell me a little bit about this new project. How did it come about? What was the inspiration? Just kind of give me the early thoughts as to this project.
Well, for the last few years, Terrence, I've been really focusing on worldview development, because in my estimation, that's really where we're going to win or lose the battle in America. We don't really have an economic crisis, a governance crisis, all these other crises the media keep talking about. The real crisis is a crisis of discipleship. And within discipleship, you can't really become a genuine, effective disciple unless you have a biblical worldview. And so when I began looking at that and realizing that, it's like, okay, so how do we go about this? And one of the most important findings out of research, probably about two decades ago, was that I discovered that a person's worldview develops between 15 to 18 months of age and 13 years of age. And so it's during that 12-year block of time in a young person's life that they're answering all the big questions in life, and they're going to retain that perspective for the rest of their years on the planet. So this is a book that's geared to trying to help parents and grandparents and pastors, coaches, mentors, teachers, everybody who influences children to understand how can we have the most positive, beneficial spiritual impact on the lives of children to develop their worldview that will lead them to become disciples of Jesus, which will then go about transforming the culture. And so we did seven brand new research projects, all for this book, projects with adolescents, projects with teenagers, projects with the parents of adolescents, projects with pastors at Christian churches, projects with adults, parents, all kinds of different things. We even did content analysis of the most popular media that children are being exposed to help our parents and grandparents and pastors in particular to understand this is what they're being fed every single day. On average, 10 hours a day of media messages to children in America. Here's what they're hearing. Here's what they're seeing. Here's what they're being taught. That's what we're up against. And so the book displays all of this information, including information about what's working in discipleship and what isn't. How can we be most effective at helping our children to become ardent followers of Christ? So for me, this is, I don't know, some people have called it a legacy book. And I think that's probably true. If I were to die and know that this was the last book I put out, I go with a smile on my face thinking, you know what? I did something that I know is very, very important. It's very timely. And I think it's a message that we in the church need to know.
You know, it's a huge message. You know, as you talk about trends, we, as we look back on three or four generations, actually looking back even at the builders generation, boomers and so forth, we have certainly seen a trend going in the wrong direction. And even today, as we look at that time, around 60-some% biblical worldview, that boomer generation, it's almost cut in half. I believe 35% biblical worldview somewhere in there.
I wish it was there. With boomers, it's 8%.
Yeah, I mean, boomers now, I mean, we're looking at 8% as we look at Gen X and then boomers, I mean, millennials. But you're telling me that the trend line is even less than that as we look at Gen Z and the alpha generations. I'm very much concerned about even, you mentioned a stat of less than 1% or around 1%. One, help us understand and clarify, because I get this question all the time, Terrence, exactly what is a biblical worldview? How are these things being measured? And so maybe you can bring some clarity to that. And why are we seeing these negative trend lines, if you will, over the last two, three generations?
Yeah, well, very simply, a worldview is the intellectual, emotional, and spiritual filter that every one of us has. That's what young kids are developing right now, that 18-month to 13-year period of time. That's what they're working on developing, answering the big questions of life. Who am I? Why am I here? How did I get here? Who do I want to be? How can I make a difference? Do I want to make a difference? What is going to be a successful life for me? How do I go about getting it? What kind of legacy do I want to leave? All of these kinds of big questions, kids start asking at about 1.5, and they don't know how to articulate it the same way that you and I do. But those are the kinds of decisions that they're going to have to make. A worldview is the filter through which we make every single decision in our life every day. And so we need a worldview to get through the day. But when we talk about worldview, understand that there are many different worldviews that people could choose. You could choose to have a Marxist worldview, a secular humanist worldview, postmodern worldview, biblical worldview, Eastern mystical worldview, moralistic therapeutic deist worldview. I mean, there are dozens of different worldviews to choose from. And what we've discovered in the research we've been doing at Arizona Christian University the last few years is that in America, we're so confused and we're so narcissistic that we don't choose a single worldview. Instead, what we do is we think we're the center of everything. It all depends on me. I've got to satisfy myself, make myself happy. So all I'm going to do is listen to what each worldview has to offer and pick and choose the elements that make me feel good. Pick and choose the elements that are going to advance my agenda in life. And that becomes our worldview, because that's what we think matters. How can I be happy? How can I be satisfied? How can I be fulfilled? And in the course of trying to get that outcome, we say, well, there is no absolute moral truth. That's up to me. You know, there are no objective outcomes for life that I need to satisfy. I just need to do the things that please me, and on and on and on down the line. So what we're looking for are people who will embrace a biblical worldview, which means that what we do, instead of looking at the world and the culture and society and our friends to determine what are the best options before us, we go to the one who created us, the one who gives us our purpose, the one who determines whether or not we're living an appropriate life, the one who establishes morals and values for us. He did that in his word, the Bible. And what we're saying is a biblical worldview is based on the principles that God has given to us for living life. So when we look at purpose in life, when we look at truth, when we look at success, when we look at marriage and morality, values, lifestyle, relationships, all of these things and more, the only way we know what's right isn't based on our feelings, which is what culture tells us. It's based on objective truth, which God alone can supply to us. And he loves us so much, and he's concerned enough about us making our choices without his guidance, that he wrote all of that in the scriptures for us to read and to memorize and to embrace and embody. And that's what a biblical worldview does. It enables us to think like Jesus. Why does that matter? Because you can't live like Jesus until you think like Jesus. Why? Because you do what you believe. So your beliefs determine your behavior, and your behavior is what will determine whether or not you become a disciple of Jesus. So you want to think like Jesus so that you can live like him. That's
you know, George, when you're speaking to this, I'm just realizing these are more than just numbers. These are more than just indicators to say, here's where we are. These numbers are indicating some significant issues within our person and our society and our communities and so forth, and even our churches. They mean things, don't they? They're not just, you know, hey, 1%, 60%, 30%, whatever. They really mean something in terms of who we are and how we function and how we look at things and evaluate things. They make a difference, don't they?
They do. And Terrence, you know, sometimes people ask me, why'd you get into research? Or, you know, it's discouraging numbers a lot of times. Why do you stay in research? And there are a few reasons, one of which is you're exactly right. The numbers are important, not because they're numbers, not simply because I believe they're an objective measure of where we stand, but because when you put them together appropriately, properly, they tell a story. And just like the Bible tells us, God's narrative about who he is, about what he created, about our role within that creation, these numbers tell us a story about how are we doing at that opportunity that God has given to us to know him, to love him, to serve him. And so that's why I continue to do the research. Yeah, it does get discouraging a lot of times. People say a lot of things about me a lot of times because I report those numbers. Yeah, I'm just the messenger, but they don't want to hear it. They don't want to deal with it. They don't want to have to change based on what the numbers are telling us. It's like, well, it's not up to me. I mean, you're going to face God, not me, at the end of your life. So you figure out whether or not you want to deal with this reality. And if you do, God has laid out a plan for us of how we can live in a way that not only is going to give us a better, happier, more satisfying, more fulfilling life, but it's one where when you and I face him at the end of our lives, we can look at him and say, yeah, I wasn't perfect, but I have Jesus covering my sins, and I did the best that I could to serve you with the gifts and the opportunities and resources you entrusted to me. And so that's why I do the research. I believe this is what he's called me to do.
Well, you know, when I looked at your new book, Raising Spiritual Champions, I'm encouraged because in this book, I believe that you are helping or giving parents and grandparents and leaders within the church even some very helpful insight, number one. Number two, you're looking at some principles that can be applied. And I mean, just so many good things. And I want to jump right into those. And talk about them, because if I understand them, you divide them up kind of in three sections, if you will, and then you even break it down further. The first section that I pulled out, and hopefully I pulled it out correctly, was you divided into kind of the importance of children and the opportunity to disciple them. You talked about how ministries are doing in terms of this discipleship process and the media's impact and so forth, and you give us certain insights. In section two, I pulled out things like unpacking what it takes to make disciples and specific patterns that characterize genuine disciples of Jesus and seven cornerstones and things like that. And then the third section that I got excited about in reading is how media and church-based ministries are impacting the lives of our children and how parents can interact with media and church to really have an impact. And I believe, and I maybe I'm just an optimist, but I believe that parents really have the primary responsibility to disciple their kids with the support, obviously, of the church and other institutions. Let's jump right in and maybe talk about these segments. I don't, you know, if there's some clarity in the segments that I have, but let's jump in and let's talk about each one around your research, around the book, and these divisions of sections. So first one, if we talked about how ministries are doing and what your research found, what are just some of the basic insights that your research found that we need to know?
Wow. Well, there are a lot of different things we can talk about. You know, first of all is the perspective that parents need to have. And it's exactly what you were alluding to. You know, it doesn't matter what you or I think. What matters is what God thinks. And what God says is if he's going to entrust children to you or me or any parent, our primary responsibility in life is to raise them up to know, love, and serve God with all their heart, mind, strength, and soul, Deuteronomy 6. And so as we're looking at that, and then we compare that to what's going on in America today, what we know is that most parents in this country aren't concerned about or have a plan for the spiritual development of their children. They're much more concerned about their academic achievement, the kinds of schools that they're admitted to, the types of jobs they're being prepared for, the kinds of opportunities that they have to excel in sports or music or other extracurricular activities. All of that is a higher priority to most American parents than whether or not the children believe God exists, whether or not they have a personal relationship with Christ, whether or not their salvation is assured, whether or not they read or study the Bible consistently, whether or not they pray to God, whether or not they're seeking to know and do his will. Those things aren't even on the radar of most parents. Why not? Well, what we found is only 2% of American parents of children under the age of 13 today have a biblical worldview. So they're not thinking about their own lives in those terms. And they're not thinking about, therefore, how can I raise my children in that way? You can't give what you don't have. So they don't have that perspective. They're not geared toward pursuing that perspective as they parent their children. So, you know, then we look at churches. How are churches doing in helping children? Well, not a whole lot better. What we find there is that only 12% of children's pastors in Christian churches across the country have a biblical worldview. The fact that 7 out of 8 children's pastors don't think like Jesus, and therefore they can't act like Jesus, but it also means they're not going to be teaching their students, children, to be like Jesus either. And so we've got an issue there. What's the responsibility of the church? Well, it's to come alongside parents and equip them to help their family constantly be following Christ, to become deep disciples, profound, genuine disciples of Jesus. But churches at large, in fact, even with adults, aren't geared to discipleship in America. We use the word, we talk about its importance, but when you analyze, as we did through our research, our goals, what we measure, the types of programs we have, what we put our resources into, we're not really discipleship maker or disciple makers. And so, you know, it's a difficult situation. And what we've got to do is blast at the foundations, because some of our baseline assumptions and priorities are just wrong. We're being more influenced by the culture than the culture is being influenced by the church. And in that process, what we're doing is we're not being geared to helping children become disciples of Jesus. We're trying to make them popular, famous, rich individuals within our society, because that's what our society esteems.
Well, on this show, let's jump into it. How can we help? How can we not be a part of that same trend? And specifically, let's go into that second section. And how can we unpack some very specific ways that we can help parents, pastors, youth leaders, disciple the next generation?
in the middle of the book, I've got four chapters where I talk about the four priorities that parents have to have if they're going to be effective at helping their children become disciples. And so, you know, the first of those chapters talks about you've got to have a life-defining commitment as a parent. I'll go into that in a moment. Secondly, you've got to identify and pursue and teach the beliefs that your children need to embrace. Third chapter talks about you've got to have the different behaviors that are important for you as a role model to be presenting to your children so that they can see these and embrace these. And then fourthly, you've got to be measuring how well you're doing. So that first chapter, that identity, life-defining identity as a parent and as a disciple and a disciple maker. You know, your identity doesn't come from the world. It comes from Christ. And the Bible lays that out for us. And we've got to embrace that. And so, you know, we look at that. And that means that if we embrace the fact that I have the primary responsibility for who these children God's entrusted to me become, I can't assume that they will become disciples by default. I've got to have a plan. And so you got to think through very carefully, what is my strategy? And for each of my strategies in raising a disciple, what tactics will I deploy? This is no different than what we do at work every day, what we do at play every day, you know, where we decide what position am I going to play? What skills do I need to develop to be effective at that position on my ball team? Or at work, you know, what's my boss going to expect of me? What kind of work do I need to turn out? What information do I need to get to turn that out? What kind of skills am I going to have to convert that information to effective output? Those are the kinds of things that we think about in the other spheres of our life. Why do we check our brain at the door when it comes to parenting and simply say, yeah, I want my kids to be happy. So I'll pay experts to do whatever they need to do to make my kids happy. You know, whether that's getting good grades, whether it's scoring the most points on their team, whether it's learning how to excel at an instrument, whatever it may be, that is the typical approach that parents are taking these days, outsourcing. It's ineffective. And when we're trying to raise disciples, it's unbiblical. So that's our job. We got to take it on. We have to be systematic about it. Secondly, we got to look at the beliefs that we want them to embrace. And here, one of the big challenges for most Christian parents, most born-again parents in America today, do not have a biblical worldview. So one way of thinking about it is, I don't want them teaching their kids what they believe today. The parents themselves need to go back. They got to go to school on scripture and figure out, what does God want us to believe? What does he teach us in his word? Parents need to go back and look at that. And in this second chapter of this middle section, I have a section where I talk about a good way of starting out at that. Because a lot of parents asked me when I was preparing to write this, where do I start? How do I do this? Okay, I'll admit, I don't have much of a biblical worldview, but I want one. How do I go about it? And so I talk about the seven cornerstones of a biblical worldview, which are seven key beliefs, very simple, but very profound. And when you take those and embrace those as the heartbeat of how you're going to think about every decision you make, that's going to transform your life. And through that, you're going to have the opportunity to transform your children's life. Teach them those seven cornerstones, and it'll change your children from day one. And then what do you do to cement that in the minds and hearts of your children? Well, you've got to show them what it looks like in practice. One of the things that we found is that the two most powerful influences on a child's worldview are family, primarily parents and grandparents, and media. And unfortunately, we found that the media are having the greatest impact today. And it's because even though parents had that opportunity, they squandered it. How did they squander it? By being bad role models for their kids. Now, in my research, I found very few parents think of themselves as bad role models. They think, I'm doing the best I can. And what we discovered from interviewing the children is that they want their parents to be their role models, but over the course of years, as they listened to what their parents said, and then they watched what their parents did, they saw a contradiction. They saw a conflict where parents would say one thing, but they do something else. For instance, they'd tell their kids, you can't watch R-rated movies. That's garbage. You can't digest that kind of information. And then late at night, they find their parents watching R-rated movies. And so what happens is the kids are sitting there trying to figure out how life works. They're looking to their parents for guidance. But when they find that their parents have a contradictory lifestyle, their conclusion, their interpretation is, my parents are just as confused as I am. So I guess I can't really trust them. So the children lose confidence in their parents. And they say, well, who's got it together that I can trust? And then they think about that 10 hours worth every day of messaging that they're being bombarded by through the arts and entertainment media that they have exposure to. And the reason that they trust that isn't because they know it's better information. They trust it because they see that it's consistent information. So they watch a 90-minute movie. They watch a 20-minute streamed video online. They listen to a 3-minute song. You know, they play a video game for 40 minutes. Whatever it may be, those different media every day are sending worldview messages to our children. I found in the content analysis that we did that very rarely is it a biblical message. Normally, it's going to be a Marxist message, a secular humanist message, a postmodern message, an Eastern mystical message, all these other worldviews. Even more often than biblical worldviews, the media are sending satanic messages. I'm not an alarmist. I'm not a conspiracy guy. But just looking at the data, the content analysis of the most popular media to which children are being exposed, I can show you those messages and how that's being communicated by Disney, by Warner, by Universal, by all the major media companies. And our kids are just sitting in front of these screens lapping it up. Why? Because over the course of that 90-minute movie, they don't veer from Marxism or secular humanism, whatever the worldview, the life philosophy is that movie is projecting. Same thing in a 3-minute song. You know, Taylor Swift or whoever, they're not giving Christianity to our kids. They're giving worldly messages to our kids, but they do it consistently. So our kids see that, and then they watch the video that goes with it and say, oh, I get it. I see how it works. That's what's happening. So our parents have to do a better job at behavioral modeling. Then finally, they got to measure it. You know, you can't just say, well, I tried hard. It's the best I can do. No, you're evaluated at work. You're evaluated on the ball field. You're evaluated everywhere you go. Why wouldn't you evaluate yourself with your parenting efforts, given that it's the single most important thing you're ever going to do in your life? That God is counting on you to raise your child to be his disciple. And it's only going to happen if you make it happen. And so it's imperative that you evaluate how you're doing at this. You know, I don't know how to write surveys. Good, I do. And I'll tell you, you don't know, you don't have to do that. The way that you evaluate what you're doing, I describe this in the book, is primarily through your relationship with your child, because disciple making is all about a relationship. And so through that relationship, you not only build the trust that enables you to communicate God's truth to your child, but it's that same relationship that enables you to spend time with your child. Why? So that you not only can teach them, but you can observe them with their friends and in different situations and evaluate, hey, those 7 cornerstones that I've been giving to them, that I've been trying to model for them, are they living them out? Do they get them well enough so that they can practice them? They become habits in their life. Mm-hmm. You can talk to your child about, hey, what would happen if somebody did such and such to you, and you start to get an idea of how they're thinking. And through a Socratic dialogue with them, you can change the course, the trajectory of their thinking so that they think more like Christ. All of these things fit together. That plan based on your commitment, knowing the beliefs that you want your children to embrace, modeling them for them through your behavior, then evaluating how that's going. This is like a cycle that never ends. And if you do it well, you're going to be raising spiritual champions.
Oh, that's so good, George. You talked about these seven cornerstones. Obviously, we can't talk about all seven here today. We'll be here too long. But give me the highlight. Give me the seven, and maybe touch on one or two, which you've already touched on. But give me those seven just in a row, so we'll have them, and take one of them and just and maybe dive deeper into it.
You know, one of the beauties, Terrence, of the seven cornerstones and of parenting, really, is that you don't have to be a theologian. You just have to be someone who wants to deeply love God, which is part of the definition of a disciple. You know, when Jesus talked about what makes a disciple in Luke 14, he talked about, you cannot be my disciple unless you love God so profoundly that in comparison, it seems like you hate everybody and everything else. It's like God first, God all the time. That's your mindset, your heart set. So yeah, loving God is critical. And if that's what you want to do, yeah, get to know these seven cornerstones, embrace them, embody them, show them to your kids through your lifestyle. You know, and they're so simple. It's like Sunday School 101. Number one is that you have to understand that not only does God exist, but who he is. How he's the all-knowing, all-caring, all-powerful creator of the universe, who's just and perfect. He still rules that universe today, and he wants that relationship with you because he created you to love you and to be loved by you. So, I mean, that's number one. Is that simple? Yeah, it's a simple concept. Now, doing it, you know, that's the tougher part. Is every choice that you make every day, every behavior that people can see in your life, you are reflecting the fact that I do this because I know a God who created me, the God, the only living God, the only omnipotent God who knows me and loves me, cares about me, has a plan for me. You know, he's leading me to do this. He gave me the gifts, the resources, the opportunity, the times, the relationships, all of those things that enable me to do this. But why do I do it? Because I know him. I'm in relationship with him. I love him. And so, you know, that leads to the second cornerstone, which is recognizing, acknowledging, and being heartbroken by the fact that we are born as sinners. There's no escaping it. Every human being who has ever been born has been born a sinner. The Bible tells us that. And if you look at your own life, it's a no-brainer to figure that out. But acknowledging that is critical. Why? Because cornerstone number three is recognizing then that the only way to deal with that sin and the importance of that sin is that it shatters our capacity to have that relationship with God. Why? Because if we go back to cornerstone number one, we said he's holy, he's perfect, he's blameless, he knows no sin, he cannot sin, and he can't be in the presence of sin. And so knowing that I'm a sinner and acknowledging that tells me right away, whoa, I got a big problem. What am I going to do about it? Cornerstone number three tells us the antidote to your sin problem is Jesus Christ, that God loved you so much that he sent his son, Jesus Christ, to earth, not simply to be human, not simply to be humiliated, but to be humiliated because of your sin and my sin. And so if we acknowledge the fact, yeah, I'm a sinner, I can't do squat about it, except recognize it, ask Jesus Christ to forgive me for those sins, let me embrace him as my savior, and make a lifelong, profound commitment to repentance, which means that I am committed to no longer doing those things that break my relationship with Jesus, cornerstone number three. Cornerstone number four, then, is, but how do I know all this? Well, I know it because God loves me so much. He put it in writing for me. He gave me the Bible. He knows I'm an idiot, that I'm not going to figure it out on my own. And so he said, okay, look, I'll give you a cheat sheet for life. And that's what the Bible is. It's a guideline for how to thrive in life every moment of every day. If you simply know and follow these instructions, it will go well for you. At cornerstone number five is recognizing, therefore, because it came from God and he is truth, If I want to know what truth is, I need to look at God because he's the embodiment of it. And then what he did is he said, look, I'll simplify it for you. I will put it in writing. So the Bible represents absolute moral truth. Truth doesn't depend on my feelings. It can't. My feelings constantly change. Truth can't depend on the circumstances. It can't. The circumstances constantly change. So I've got to have a source that is unchanging, objective, eternal truth. That is God. And he put it in the scriptures for us, which leads us to truth number six, which is, so what am I supposed to do with all this? How should I live? You know, Francis Schaeffer once famously asked that question, his title of the book, How Then Shall We Live? How Then Shall We Live? And the answer is, I'm here for a simple reason. That's to know, love, and serve God with all my heart, mind, strength, and soul. You can find that in Mark 12, verse 30 and beyond. You know, it's very simple conceptually. Doing it is tough. But that's why beliefs must be translated into behavior. That's what that's about. That's what a disciple is. A disciple isn't the same as being a theologian. Theologians know a lot of biblical truth. I'm not the judge here, but I will tell you that because they're human and because I've studied these things in terms of people's lives, most theologians are not disciples. They know a lot of truth. They're not converting it into a lifestyle that's transformative for them and everybody around them. Then the seventh cornerstone is to be able to look at all of those six and say, but what is it? What does it lead to? How do I know when I'm successful? Is it because people recognize that I've got more biblical knowledge than anybody else? Is it because God has blessed me with the biggest house on the block and I've got a Porsche in the driveway? Is it because I believe that marriage is one man and one woman and he gave me the most beautiful wife in the world? No, success is obedience to God, consistent obedience to God. That's all it is. You may be a homeless person out on the streets, begging for food, going through the trash, looking for food, wearing filthy rags, and you could be a complete success in life. If you're living a life where you're being completely obedient to God, God never promises us worldly success. He promises us eternal joy and peace if we're consistently obedient to him here in this life. Recognizing that we're sinners, we need Jesus. Again, all these things fit together. And so when you put them together, it works. And this is not the totality of a biblical worldview, but this is a great foundation on which to build a biblical worldview. Why? And how do I know this? Because I went through the data, and what I discovered is when you believe and live these seven things, you've got an 83% probability of going on to develop a full-on biblical worldview, which means then you're most likely or you're going to be a disciple. However, if you do not buy into all seven of these cornerstones, you've only got a 2% probability of becoming a disciple, of building a biblical worldview and becoming a disciple. So I can't stress enough. Look, as a parent, you've only got to be about 10 seconds ahead of your kids. And so, you know, as long as you get there before they do, and you know these things, and you're living these things, and they're hearing this from you, and they're seeing this from you, you're going to lead them in the right direction.
Yeah, I'm talking with George Barna, and he has a new book that's out, Raising Spiritual Champions, which is so powerful. How do we nurture our child's heart, mind, and soul? Question for you, George, as we wrap up. I'm listening and I hear, if I'm a disciple, if I'm a follower of Christ, and I'm seeking maturity and to impart that to my children as well, something hit me as you were speaking to say, well, if I don't believe in God, I don't believe in the Bible, I don't believe in any of these spiritual truths, no one is actually, maybe I don't believe because no one has shared them with me in a way that's simple, plain, and straightforward. I'm not necessarily rejecting. I just don't know them. But if I did know them, oh, I would have a different view. Talk to me for a minute about the non-Christian, the non-disciple, the non-saved, the non-believer, whatever you want to call them. Those who have never accepted or said, hey, by faith, I believe that this is all true. And I should be examining this as a parent, as an individual, as a grandparent, etc., to impart this to my grandchildren, to my children, to the next generation. What would you say to the non-Christian, to the un-Christian, to the unchurched?
Well, if you're really interested in checking it out, you know, we have a lot of guilt in the Christian community about, oh my gosh, we're not going out to do enough for others. But I mean, there's responsibility on both sides of the equation. If it's going to be a relationship, then both people have responsibility and a commitment to that relationship. So if you're, you know, somebody who I would call a don't, somebody who, you know, says that they don't believe God exists, or they don't know if God exists, or they don't care if God exists, they're not sure why they should care if God exists. That's about 3 out of 10 Americans. And so it's a large number of people. It's more people than have a biblical worldview by a factor of 4. And, you know, 5, actually. So, you know, what I would say is, if you really want to check it out, just to cover yourself, if for nothing else, almost as an insurance policy. It's like, look, I'm not buying it now, but some people believe this. It's really, really important to them. They stake their life on it, these disciples of Jesus. Maybe I should at least check it out before I write it off for good. What would I recommend you do? Go find somebody, not who calls themselves a Christian, because there are a lot of those people. In America today, 2 out of every 3 adults call themselves Christians. By the research that I'm doing here in terms of real disciples of Jesus, who are, I mean, I would say those are the real Christians. They're willing to die for it. One of the studies we did, we evaluated that. Would you die for this faith? And, you know, we're finding that people have a biblical worldview. People want to be disciples of Jesus. They're committed to it. They're willing to die for it. They don't mind being persecuted for their faith. Yeah, they don't enjoy it, but they don't. They're willing to be persecuted for it. We're talking about roughly 5% of the population. And so, if that's the case, find one of that 5%, not somebody who talks the game, but somebody who's living the game. Because that's what Jesus was about. He talked the game, but he also lived it. And that's why his disciples were willing to follow him. There were a lot of religious teachers in his day, but he lived differently. They kept saying, wow, there's something unique about this guy. The way that he treats people, the approach to life that he takes, doesn't even have a house. He's not looking to have a house. He's got this one set of clothing he wears. You know, to him, he kept the important things important, and he was different. So look for one of those kind of people and build a relationship with that individual so that you can have deep conversations, philosophical, theological conversations about what do you believe? Why do you believe it? How do you know that's true? What does that look like in your life? Those are the kinds of things you want to dig into, because that's the only kind of stuff that's ultimately going to have the power to transform what you already believe. You already have a worldview. As a don't, your worldview has already been shaped and formed. It's deep. And so if you're going to change it, normally it takes a crisis in life for that to happen. That's the time when you actually question what you believe. But maybe the fact that you would be looking at having somebody to talk to about these things now indicates, yeah, I've been through that kind of a crisis. What I found in my research is things like an acrimonious divorce, spending time in jail or prison, going bankrupt, losing all your stuff in a natural disaster, a fire, a flood. These are the kinds of things, you know, contracting a debilitating illness, somebody that you deeply loved going through a painful death experience. These are the kinds of crises that cause people to question, what's life about? Is there a God? What's the nature of that God? And so the best way to deal with it is find an individual who you think has answered these kinds of questions about what life is about, and spend time with them, dig deep with them. If they're really a disciple of Jesus, they will welcome that opportunity. If they're scared off by it, you got the wrong person. You want somebody who is a disciple, because their objective in life is to make disciples. And I promise you, I mean, there should be no hidden objectives here. That disciple is going to want to see you become a disciple of Jesus. Why? Because to those of us who are disciples, that's what life is about. And so the greatest gift that we could ever give to you would be that we could spend time with you. We could live life with you in such a way that you would begin to understand who God is and why he loves you and why he sent Jesus for you, which he did, and why he did that and what it could look like in your life and what's going to have to change and what the ultimate results of that change will be and what it's going to mean for you to be able to rest easy knowing that when you embrace Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, because you've given up on sinning, you've given up on the world, you're all about God and his ways, you can rest easy knowing that you're going to live next to him in heaven for eternity. I know this. Terrence knows this. Those of us who are disciples know this. We've been through enough with God, with Jesus, and with the world that we get it. We've lived it. We know this is the case. We know it is fact. We'd love to share that with you, but take that step. It's a bold step. It's a hard step, but what have you got to lose? I mean, if you don't like what they say, go your own way. See how that turns out. None of us can force you to follow Jesus, but we want
George,
to.
George, it has been a pleasure. We might as well, pack your bags and get on the road here. My prayer, as we look at all of this, is really, I tried to capture as best I could in my book, Do Your Children Believe? At the end of the day, the question for parents and grandparents is, do your children believe? And that's our Jerusalem. And then, of course, he may call some of us to Samaria. George, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Again, the book is Raising Spiritual Champions. How can my listeners get a copy? What's the website you'd like to point us to? Give me some details.
Yeah, the book is available at Amazon, amazon.com. It's paperback. We've also got a digital version, so you can get it either way. And all the research that we're doing related to these and many more things is available for free at culturalresearchcenter.com. And so I hope people will take advantage of that.
And I always encourage my listeners, don't buy one book. Go buy 10. Get 10 and distribute some to your friends. Be a blessing, right? Your generosity and make these a gift. We have holidays coming up, Christmas and so forth. And even before that, I mean, this is a powerful resource. So thank you, George, again, for your time, your research, just the cornerstones and so many other things. It's been a blessing. And thank you for your friendship.
Likewise, Terrence, I appreciate it. God bless you.
God bless you.